to preface this week's session, I would like to offer a one-minute summary of one very central idea that we looked at in last week's session. Last week, we presented a composite of the life of Maimonides, the life of the Rambam, the greatest of all of the medieval Jewish thinkers, the ones who contribute so much to the rich tradition of medieval Jewish philosophy. And we spoke not only about his life, but also about the thread, the basic fabric of Rambam's philosophy, of his thought. And that is that the goal and objective initially for Maimonides is to address his community of Jews who are people of speculation, individuals who study philosophy, who have familiarity with Aristotelian philosophy, and believe that that philosophical system to be in fact true and appropriate, who are also, on the other hand, people of faith and tradition, and who see contradictions between what is presented by the philosophers on the one hand and what is presented to them through the Torah on the other hand. And so the initial goal of Maimonides is to address this community and to share with them his belief, which is that there is harmony, there is coexistence between philosophy and the words of the Torah. And he believes that this can be accomplished by clearing up two points of confusion. One is by explaining various terms that are used in the Torah. And the second is by explaining nevuot, various prophecies which appear in the Tanakh, which are specifically parables, which are mishalim. And we said that what the Rambam does in his philosophical magnum opus, the Mora Nevuchim, the Guide of the Perplexed, is that he goes beyond what the other his predecessors in the world of Jewish philosophy have done, in that he maintains that there is not only harmony between these two seemingly opposing worlds of philosophy and Torah, but that beyond that, a step further than that, is that the philosophy and, I'm sorry, that the Torah is actually a source for philosophical understanding. And that while the outer layer of the Torah is non-philosophical, the Pshat is accessible to all individuals, there exists a more precious layer to many of the prophetic parables in Tanakh, which are placed there in order to communicate philosophical truths about God and his world through the text of the Torah. And it is those people who are philosophically inclined, who are people of speculation, people who are not satisfied to simply accept what the true beliefs are through tradition, but wish to verify those truths, wish to speculate and think about the existence of God, and think about their belief systems, and think about how God interacts with this world, and what a man's duty as a Jew, as a religious person, is in this world. Those individuals will, in fact, peel off the outer layer and find this hidden treasure, what the Rambam classified as the golden apple. They will find the golden apple that is the essence. The emet la'amitah, an expression that we've heard the Rambam use to express this idea that the Torah contains this very internal esoteric truth, and those who are qualified, those who have the proper training and the proper prerequisites to this divine science will, in fact, when they're pointed in that direction, which is the goal of the Mora Nebuchim, they will find the hidden truth of the philosophical hidden truth of that's present in the Torah. So again, it's not only that there is harmony and synthesis, but that in fact the Torah itself is a very valuable source for philosophical inquiry. And that is a tremendous contribution. We said last week that the Rambam has bequeathed to the world of Machshavat Yisrael, the world of medieval Jewish philosophy. In today's session, we build upon last week's session, and we hope to present the elements of the Rambam's philosophy that presented to be controversial to some of his contemporaries and to those that come in later generations. The controversy over the Rambam begins in his early years, but it extends beyond his own lifetime. It of course reaches its climax with the very tragic burning of his philosophical work in the year 1232. That's shortly after his death. Rambam dies in 1204. And it extends, one can argue, even beyond and past that time of controversy as well. As the time moves further away from the Rambam's life, it becomes less specific to the Rambam and to his philosophy, and becomes a more general question of how or whether one should be, as a religious individual, studying outside philosophy, secular philosophy, and how that can be potentially, those who are the anti-Maimonideans believe that it would be dangerous to one's philosophical, one's religious belief system to engage in the study of philosophy. So in one of the later reincarnations of the debate over Maimonides, it was no longer talking about placing a ban against studying Rambam's work. It becomes much more general, and looks like a ban placed on anyone under a certain age studying any philosophy. Again, because it's seen to be a much more general issue, not only specific to the Rambam's thought. Today we look at two sources, and I hope that we can have the opportunity here to break down the controversy of the Rambam into two very distinct stages. One being the controversy within his own lifetime, of which he was very much aware of and predicted. And the second being the historical controversy that took place shortly after his lifetime that was triggered by the translation of the Mora Nebuchim into Hebrew from its original Arabic, and ultimately which comes to a very quick halt with the burning of the Rambam's work in 1232. Before we do get to those historical stages, we would like to paint here a picture of what the Rambam anticipates about his work. In other words, what type of reception does the Rambam feel his work will be deserving of? And then in fact we can follow up with the confirmation of his own hesitations and his own concerns about how his work will be received. And this comes from the Rambam's introduction to his Guide of the Perplexed, to the Mora Nebuchim. And the first source that we're going to look at on today's Daf Makarot is an interesting piece, because the Rambam here says that while his goal, as stated, is to remove difficulties for people who, again, are reading the Torah. Now he's talking specifically about those prophetic parables. They're reading those Mishalim, and they are perplexed, again, because they're understanding them in their literal sense. Well, the Rambam promises that he will do two things when it comes to those parables. Number one, he will tell you that they are parables, which, as we saw last week, he feels can already remove someone's perplexity just by telling them that the parable needs to be understood in a non-literal sense. But beyond that, he hopes to explain the meaning, and by this we can recognize that he's referring to the deeper esoteric meaning of those prophetic parables. And then he offers this disclaimer in source number one. Ein ani omer shesefer zeh misalek kol koshi l'mevinato. So the Rambam says, wait, I don't mean to say that this work is going to remove all the difficulties of the people who are reading this book and understand it. I'm only maintaining that my goal here is to explain, rectify most of the questions, to answer most of the questions and the greater ones of the questions. Adam Navon lo yidrosh meni, lo yisapeh, shebehatiri inyan mitsuyam asher mimato. So perhaps we can understand that the Rambam wants to offer as a disclaimer here in his introduction to his Mor Nevuchim that although he's going to discuss the meaning of these different parables, he can't possibly get to all of them or to every detail of all of them and answer all difficulties, but he goes a step beyond that. He says, but a person should not expect from me that when I do mention one of these nishalim, that I'm going to complete the topic, right? You shouldn't expect that I'm going to fully discuss the subject matter at hand. Osha kasher atzil leva'er mashmuto shel mashal min hamishalim emsa kol hanemar boto mashal. In other words, it seems at first glance that what the Rambam is telling us is that he's going to do a partial job. He can't possibly explain to us everything that there is to say about a mashal, and he can't even complete the discussion of any particular mashal, so off of that, one should not even expect that of the Rambam. And the question is, why this disclaimer? In other words, why not? Why can't the Rambam speak in complete sentences? Why can't he speak fully about each topic which he sets out to speak about? And the reason that he cites for his limitation that is preventing him from discussing in full what he would like to discuss is a Mishnah which he himself quotes in source number two. The Mishnah says, "Ein dorshim maaseh bereshis b'shnayim." This Mishnah is talking about two subjects which are esoteric traditions. One which is called maaseh bereshis, which refers to the story of creation, and by that we refer to the physics of the creation. And the second subject matter refers to Merkava. That's referring to Ma'aseh Merkava, what the Rambam calls divine science, or the esoteric tradition that emerges from the Ma'aseh Merkava, the story of the chariot, in Sefer Yechezkel. So when it comes to these two topics, there are limitations that Chazal place upon us from studying these topics in full. In other words, Ein Dorshim B'Maaseh Bereshit B'Shnayim, one is not permitted to learn the subject of Maaseh Bereshit in pairs. So in other words, one is only allowed to study individually, one-on-one, with someone who is the recipient of the knowledge of what is contained in this esoteric idea of Maaseh Bereshit. The Lobe Merkava B'Yachid. When it comes to divine science, when it comes to Maaseh Merkava, the limitation is even greater. Even one person cannot study Maaseh Merkava. So in other words, the limitation seems to be that even an individual, not about learning in pairs, even an individual cannot be taught Maaseh Merkava. Only Ella im kein hayachacham mevin midato. So there's one stipulation here at the end of this Mishnah, which says that Maaseh Merkava can be taught to one person if that one person is deemed to be exceptionally wise and he's someone who has the independent study capability and would be able to understand this topic, these very esoteric discussions on his own. The Rambam here expresses the fact that in his Mor Nevuchim, he wishes to expound on these two subjects, on the subject of Maaseh Bereshit, which he refers to as natural science, and on the subject of Maaseh Merkava, which is the divine science. However, he's presented with limitations. The Mishnah is limiting him in the sense that he is not permitted to expound on these topics in a public sense. Again, technically, according to the Mishnah, he should only be able to expound on Maaseh Bereshit to one other person, and he should only be allowed to explain Maaseh Merkava to one person if he can verify that that person is the proper recipient of this very esoteric information. And so the question that we ask on the Rambam, and others have asked previously, is what right or what justification does the Rambam have in discussing these two topics, Maaseh Bereshit and Maaseh Merkava, in his Moreh Nevuchim, if he is aware of the Mishnah and he expresses that he wishes to respect the statements of the Mishnah and wishes not to violate it, and yet at the same time he sets out his goal to explain it. So clearly the hint as to what the Rambam's way of avoiding violation of this Mishnah brings us back to source number one. In other words, the Rambam is telling us it's not simply that he's limited by the pen. In other words, he's limited because he doesn't have the time to treat each mashal in its fullness, or it's not necessarily that he doesn't have the knowledge to do so, but he is limited in terms of the length and extensiveness of the explanation, of how much he is permitted to expound on these matters. He senses that limitation, and that's going to guide what he chooses to write and how he chooses to write it. Now, there are some who would like to argue somewhat creatively that the Rambam himself, when he writes his Mor Nevuchim, he actually addresses it to his Talmid Mufak, to his most exceptional student, Rabbi Yosef. And this letter that he writes, which is a letter of dedication that he writes to his student, that in the text of the Mor Nevuchim comes before the Haksama. I brought an excerpt here in source number 3 that perhaps can help us understand how the Rambam felt that he could discuss these matters in his Mor Nevuchim. Source number 3, I apologize that it did not get translated, but I'll translate here. I'll just preface the first paragraph without going inside. Rambam is having what was initially a one-on-one contact with his student, and now he's had a letter correspondence with his student. And his student sending him letters with questions relating to philosophy. And now I turn to verse number 3 in the underlined paragraph. Zot me'az higi'uni hirotecha u'machborotecha me'alexandria. I have been receiving your letters, your correspondences, your notebooks which are coming from Alexandria. But before I began to study, to read and to examine what you've written, I had not yet literally tested you on your ability to grasp. As Amarti, Shemati Shukatov Dolame Hasagatel. So I naturally thought and suspected that perhaps your desire and your interest, your motivation to know, is greater than your ability to grasp. But what I saw is that when you studied all of these prerequisite sciences I was overcome with this tremendous joy because I was able to measure your praiseworthy mind and your quick and agile ability to grasp and to understand. I'm going to skip down to the next underlying passage of this paragraph. Line of the paragraph, I saw that you have all of these questions, again, relating to the relationship between faith and reason. And I see that you are tremendously perplexed and bewildered, and that you have this tremendous desire to understand and to reconcile these two differences. Finally, Rambam, in the last underlying section of this paragraph, says, as a result, I have therefore made my decision to compose this work, the Mor Nebuchim, for you specifically, and for those who are like you, the Hem Mu'atim, and there are few. In other words, Rambam's not writing this for a wide audience. He's not writing this work for the masses. He's writing for a very specific niche of Jews, of Jewish intellectuals who are plagued by these contradictions. And therefore, there have been some who have said that the Rambam is writing for a very specific audience, and before he writes for his particular student, he in fact measures his knowledge, and he tests his student's ability to grasp. And it's only until he's convinced of how talented and how well-educated his student is in the realm of natural sciences and metaphysics that he's willing to share with him the divine science that his student is so craving. And so perhaps we can say that the Rambam is writing this book for a very specific audience, and therefore he is, in essence, not in violation of the Mishnah, in the sense that he's directing this to a specific individual or to a specific few individuals who he feels are deemed worthy of responsibly accepting this information and this knowledge. Rambam goes on, and then we refer back in certain before to his Mor Nebuchim, to his introduction to his Mor Nebuchim. Rambam says, because I am limited by the Mishnah, Masachat Chagiga, Lachain, verse number 4, I'll be Jerusha Menitan El Roshay Parkin. You should not expect from me that I'm going to give you a full explanation of these very esoteric subject matters. We should only expect chapter headings. The Rambam here tells us about his extraordinary creative literary device. The Rambam tells us that he's only going to give us the chapter headings to, again, these two very esoteric subjects of Maaseh Bereishit, Maaseh Merkavah, but even these subject headings will not be in an organized way. And they will not only not be in an organized way, but they also will not be consecutive. Ela mevudadot umuravot b'minim achirim shevertonim mahatiram. So in other words, what the Rambam is attempting to do is to take these ideas, or at least the general themes of these two subject matters, these two esoteric subject matters, and essentially what he's trying to do is disperse them throughout his other discussions in the Mor Nebuchim. And what is his goal? Sheken kavanati sheha'amitut tof'ana mi'ba'ad roshay prasim v'shuv tisafrena. My goal is that the truth, and we're talking, of course, here about the philosophical esoteric truth, should be glimpsed at and then should be concealed again. For what ultimate goal? Because I don't wish to oppose the divine purpose. In other words, I am working here very hard to express the ideas that I feel are important to express to this genre of philosophical, to this group of philosophical Jews. But I do not wish to, heaven forbid, violate what the limitations the mission has placed upon me. So again, Rambam invents this brilliant creative and creative literary style where he will present the ideas, but it will be in a disorganized fashion and will be dispersed throughout other topics in his book, and it will, in so doing, limit his audience to a reader who not only has the prerequisite knowledge, but has the motivation and the ability to grasp and the patience to study the entire Morning Bulletin and to take out the glimpses from each of the sections where there are references to these topics and to arrange them in his own mind in a orderly and productive fashion. And so the Rambam here brilliantly limits the audience in the way that he presents the information on these two topics. Scroll down to the next page. At the end of the introduction to the Rambam's Morne Buchim, Rambam provides instructions to his reader. And he instructs his reader to read the book from the beginning to the end. He offers the following expression of his own hesitation when reading the book in verse number 6. V'hakel yitala yodea v'tamid yir'eti ma'od ma'od l'chtov et hadvarim shibrasoni l'chtov v'sefazeh. Rambam says, there are things that I wanted to write in this book, that I have written in this book, that I have been fearful, exceedingly fearful and apprehensive about writing in this book, Mikivan Shehem Divrei Sefer. Because what I'm trying to accomplish here is to share with my audience things, subjects that are hidden matters. Shelo nechtav aleihem sefer v'umav yimei hagalut ha'eila. No work has ever been written. There has never been a written type of modern, for his period, a modern work on these subject matters. It's mitzad achadesh anisi yushav aleihem. Therefore, I was apprehensive because how can I then innovate and come and write these books, write this work and set down these ideas which have been passed down through tradition? How can I now commit them to writing? Verse number 7, very fascinating parallel the Rambam makes. Elishihi samachti afsheh nachot. The Rambam says, I have allowed myself to, given myself the right to commit these ideas to writing based on two premises. Premise number 1. Achat mashamu chazal al me'in inyan zeh, eit lasot la'ashem hekiru toratacha. The first premise that I am relying on in writing my work is in what Chazal did, in other words, what was the choice of Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi, who chose to literally uproot the Torah, if you want to understand a passage from Tehillim literally. It's a time to do for the Lord. Right, I have uprooted the Torah. I need to uproot the Torah for the sake of Hashem. That, of course, was the premise on which the Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi relied upon to commit the words of the Mishnah to paper, to take what was Torah Shebaal Peh, what was oral tradition, and to commit it to writing. Rambam sees the same parallel here. There is a need. It has perhaps previously, before my time, been a successful model to have these ideas passed down through tradition. It is no longer possible, and I need to therefore uproot the ideal in order to do for the sake of Hashem. The second premise that the Rambam relies upon, v'chol ma'asecha yiyu l'shem shemayim, let all your acts be for the sake of heaven. And of course, the Rambam reiterates a number of times that although he has hesitated in writing his book, he has done it for the sake of the good, for the sake of the good of people, in order to literally provide continued faith for this class of intellectual Jews in his generation. The Rambam recognizes that his work will arouse controversy, and that there will be people who will oppose his decision to uproot the Torah, and people will oppose the right that he feels and will not recognize the need that he, same need that he sees. And he addresses this audience in verse number 8. So I know that whoever is out there who is a beginner, asher lo lamad davar min ha'iyun, right? Someone who has not necessarily been in advanced speculation courses, yafik to'elet mikama miferkeseh v'zeh. So I know they're going to gain something from this book. The ilu ha'isha shalem, the person who is a complete person, ben Torah, kafisha marti navuch, I know the person who is a man of faith, a religious person, but who is perplexed because of philosophy, who is navuch, yafik to'elet mikol matat. He will find purpose and benefit from every chapter of this book. My writings will be so pleasing for his eye. On the other side of the coin, the ilu hamivubalim, for those people who are confused, asher mochoteham luchuchu v'deos she'inan nechonos, whose minds have been polluted by false ideas and opinions, that these people think, of course, that what they believe is in fact true, and they also think we're very smart and philosophical, when in reality they don't at all, their thoughts do not correspond to the chokhmah be'emet, to true wisdom, halalu yirtu'u mipratim rabin b'sefer. I know that when they read this book, there will be many ideas that will cause them to tremble. Umama odikshu alehem, and it will be very difficult for them. Mikivan shehem lo yasigu bahem mashma'ut klal, because they will not understand anything I'm trying to convey. Umikivan shemitocham yitbarer shepsulim hamaseot hamiluyasim shediyadam. But more importantly, these chapters will be very difficult for them because it's going to lead them to recognize that what they have in their hands is counterfeit money. In other words, that their religious system is counterfeit, does not have a correspondence to the reality of truth, does not correspond to system of philosophy, system of theology that is based upon true beliefs that stem from speculation, that stem from one's own mind. And therefore, the Rambam recognizes that he will be condemned by this group of individuals. They will psychologically be so repelled by the Mor Nebuchim because it will point to them, point out to them the falseness of their theological system. However, the Rambam concludes in verse number 9, even though that's the case, he knows that he has a need. He has a need that he has to fulfill, and he's willing to endure the critique. The Sikumo Shel Davar, verse number 9, Ani Ha'ish, Asher Bahasik Lo Inyan B'Sara Lo Haderech, I'm the person who, when the concern pressed him and his way was straightened and he could find no other device by which to teach or demonstrate the truth, the lo yimaseh tachbula lemed emet, sheyesh aleha hochacha mafsid, etc., etc. Hareni, I'm skipping to the underline, Hareni ma'adif, lomar zod lo levado. I rather cater to that particular individual who will benefit from a demonstrated truth, Ve'enei sho'et al ha'dinai sho'otam amram. But I will not be concerned with the negative feedback that will come from the masses, from that amra, from the masses of the ignoramuses. I prefer to address that single person, and I will not heed the blame of those other many people. Why? Because Vasim Libi Lachalit Otel Yachid Mi'uleh Mi'Hasavach Shem Yisadach Lo. Because what I hope to do in writing this book is to liberate that virtuous one, in other words, that person who just needs a bit of assistance to become a perfected religious thinking Jew, someone who has engaged in philosophy and is a man of faith, but needs me to show the link and the connection between the two. And I will guide him in his perplexity until he becomes perfect, and most importantly, until he finds menucha, until he finds rest, and is no longer plagued by this terrible dilemma that he feels having to choose between his mind and his faith. Expresses for us the idea that the Rambam was well aware of the challenges that he would face in producing a work like the Marne Bukhim, and he was well aware that he would be condemned, and the work would be condemned by many of his readers, and he chose to fulfill a need, a tremendous need, in a small and limited group of Jews, rather than to be concerned with what others, who he considers to be ignoramuses, for even if they are learned, they are not learned in what's the most important science to be learned in, which is the science of God. And so the Rambam himself chooses to accept what will later come as the harsh response to his work for the sake of the good, for the sake of that group of people who we've been discussing for a number of sessions. Now, this idea that there is not only harmony between faith and reason, but that the Torah itself is a source of philosophy, and therefore the Rambam opens his Morne Buchim by explaining the term Tselem, the term image, the literal translation of the term Tselem. He's trying to explain the pasuk Na'ase Adam B'Tzelmeinu. What does it mean that we are created in the image of God, in the Tselem of God? So he wishes to explain in the first parak of the Morne Buchim that the word Tselem is, in Hebrew, is not the word to connote physical image, but is rather the word Toar, as in the description of Yosef. Yosef is Yosef Toar, referring to his physical image, his physical beauty. And so the Rambam maintains that Tselem, he uses various proof texts to show that Tselem refers to that which makes something, which defines something, which gives something its essence. And so that we are not created, as many Jews had originally thought incorrectly, in the corporeal image of God, but rather that we are created in the essence of God. For the Rambam, the essence of God is divine intellect, and therefore we're created with a portion, we are connected to God's divine intellect, and certainly the motivational component of this first Parak in Morne Buchim is very obvious. It is man's duty to, at the simplest level, for him, one should feel empowered to utilize their intellect in connecting with God. Utilize their intellect to understand God, to attempt to understand God, even though he does maintain their limitations to what we can understand about God in our physical state. But we are created in that way, and we have then the ability, in turn, to understand various elements and truths about God. And that is the running thread of his philosophy, the focus on the intellect as the tool as a mechanism in our fiber and as religious individuals. And that idea was seen by many. This focus on the philosophy and the Aristotelianism was seen by many as exceedingly controversial. And the Rambam has to deal with a number of arrows that were being targeted toward him at once. In other words, the overarching issue that individuals or leaders thought problematic, even if they didn't articulate in this way, was certainly the attempt of the Rambam to harmonize philosophy and Torah, to synthesize the two as well. Then there were specific issues that were all outgrowths of this very basic premise in what the Rambam sees as a system of Jewish theology that presents as challenging for him. In the Rambam's lifetime, it was not the Mor Nebuchim, which was the source of the most intense controversy, but it was rather his writings in the Mishnah Torah. As we mentioned in last discussion, the Rambam composed a halakhic work, his magnum opus in the world of halakha. His attempt to codify halakha in 14 volumes, which he titled the Mishnah Torah, which is the second to the Torah, for the Rambam expresses in Hakdamas Mishnah Torah that he envisioned that one would only need a Tanakh and a Mishnah Torah on one shelf. One would have the opportunity, the ability to bypass it seems from his introduction, one can bypass the study of the Gemara if one needed the bottom line, the very practical halakha. And that in and of itself was seen as controversial by many of his generations. In particular, the Ravid, Rav Avraham ben David of Plasterius, who writes critical glosses, critical notes on the Mishnah Torah, points out to the fact that while the Rambam claims in his Hakdama to Mishnah Torah that he's doing this for the good, for the sake of those Jews who, in his current setting, do not have the capability to hover over the tractates of Talmud in attempt to extrapolate practical halakha, he would offer to them in a more accessible format. Nonetheless, the Ravid critiques the Rambam and feels that although he tries, he thinks he's done something that has been beneficial, he has actually done something which has been very destructive by writing the Mishnah Torah. And so in the Rambam's lifetime, the work which elicited the greatest controversy was the Mishnah Torah itself. And again, it was both because of the purpose and the goal with which the Rambam which directs him in writing the book. It relates to the style in which he writes the work, the first very neat system, system borrowed from the Greek, which is a system of codification, the easy access, the fact that the Rambam does not include footnotes, does not cite his sources, and at times presents conclusions which are not clearly derived from the outcomes of discussions in the Talmud. And so for a variety of reasons, the Mishnah Torah was seen as controversial. The portion of the Mishnah Torah which generated the most controversy, of course, was the first book of Mishnah Torah. Sefer Maza, the first volume of Mishnah Torah, was the Rambam's attempt to offer some basic philosophical beliefs, a system of philosophical beliefs for the masses of Jews. Again, not for the intellectual elite, for them he had already been planning his Mor Nebuchim, but for the everyday average Jew who needs to have some very basic true conceptions about God, the Rambam devotes his Sefer Mazah, his Book of Knowledge. This attempt of the Rambam to include philosophy, really his intent was to include it as a preface and as a prerequisite to the practice of halakha. In other words, before one can attempt to be a religious practicing Jew, one needs to have some basic beliefs which are true and which have been verified by the mind and thought of that individual. And so the Rambam feels that it is critical that one first study Sefer Mazah, the first book, and then one can delve into the halakha, the practical outgrowth of what it means to be a philosophical thinking religious person. There were those in the Rambam's generation and soon after, who felt that the Rambam assumed two separate selves, and they felt that they had the right to pick and choose. So although even the Rambam's generation, for example, even the halacha component of the Mishnah Torah was deemed controversial, soon after his death, the Rambam's Mishnah Torah is recognized for its brilliance and genius as a code of halacha. And so in that period, Jewish leaders felt that they would certainly offer the Mishnah Torah its due respect for the absolute genius that the Rambam presents there, but they wished to reject Sefer Mazah. And of course, as we've expressed in a number of opportunities in these sessions, that bifurcation of the Rambam is unfair. The Rambam maintains that the prerequisite to halakha is being a thinking religious person. The controversy within the Rambam's lifetime, as I mentioned, the most intense element of it came from the introduction of the Mishnah Torah, and in particular, we know that the Rambam is what he feels unfairly accused toward the end of his life of being a unbeliever, of not believing in a belief which he actually canonized in his 13 principles of faith, the belief in the resurrection of the dead. And the Rambam is accused in the year 1191, I'll scroll down to the excerpts from the letter that he writes. This year, 1191, a letter arrived from some of my colleagues in Baghdad, in which they wrote that an individual from Yemen inquires regarding the self-same issues of Shmuel Halevi, the incumbent head of the academy, may God protect him, who at present resides at Baghdad. He composed an essay on resurrection, and in it he calls some of my views an error and sin. This letter that the Rambam writes at the end of his lifetime is a tragic work. The Rambam is forced at the end of his life to defend himself. He is the one who essentially spent his entire life attempting to instill in people a system of belief, even in a group of people who would not naturally, based upon their background and education, have a system of belief. He felt that they too needed a system of belief, and so they would be the beneficiaries of his Sefer Mazah, and then the intellectual elite, of course, would have his Morning Rufin. Well, the Rambam, at the very end of his life, is forced to write a letter defending himself, and he entitles this letter, he calls the Essay on Resurrection. And he points a direct finger at one of his Talmudic colleagues, points a finger at Shmuel Halevi. This is the Gaon of Baghdad, who the Rambam clashes with on a number of occasions on halakhic issues. Here, the accusation that is made, which the Rambam feels is, of course, unjustified, is that the Rambam rejects the belief in resurrection of the dead in the Asimuti. The Rambam writes this essay to explain both why one might have thought that he did not believe or that he denied resurrection, and also he verifies for the community that he in fact does maintain the belief in the Asimuti. The basic premise is that the Rambam, looking at the generation before his own eyes, the generation of whom he calls ignoramuses, the Ami Ha'aret, who don't have a system of belief, who the Rambam feel are too focused on the material reward. And he feels that they're so focused on the material reward that they have assumed this obsession with the doctrine of resurrection of the dead. The Rambam wished to upgrade the sophistication of the people, of the Ami Ha'aretz in his generation. And he tries to motivate them to worship God not out of interest in reward and not out of fear of punishment, but for the sake of doing good in himself. This he discusses at the end of his Hilchot Tshuva, where he talks about the concept of lo lishma and lishma. And he feels that most people worship God, most of the masses of Jews worship God lo lishma. It's not for the sake of the mitzvah. It's not for the sake of the worship. It's not for the sake of having a relationship with God, but it's for the sake of, most often, being afraid of punishment, or for the sake of being afraid that one will not get the reward that they desire. And the Rambam tries to, again, offer them a more sophisticated approach to Avodat Hashem, to worship of God, and to show them that one needs to worship God for the sake of the worship and not for some external reward, and certainly not for what he sees as a material reward, which is Kriyas Melechim. And so the Rambam expresses in this essay of resurrection that when he was writing his Sefer Maza, the first book of Mishneh Torah, as philosophy for dummies, right, philosophy for the masses, what he wished to do was to emphasize a doctrine which he believed had been neglected in his generation, and replace it, right, in other words, transfer the focus from the doctrine on resurrection to focusing on a belief which he felt was a more sophisticated goal, which is Olam Haba, which is the afterlife, the world of the soul. And the Rambam recognizes, once he is accused by not the masses, but one of the Talmudic elites, or the leading Talmudic elite individual in his generation, what the Rambam recognizes is that he has been misunderstood and misconstrued by his audience, and therefore he writes this essay of resurrection with a heavy heart, with a great sense of resentment, and perhaps we can argue that he feels that while he made the choice to not only focus on the intellectual elite and to offer, to attempt to raise the sophistication of the masses of Jews to a higher level, ultimately his message and his goals, the way he sees it, perhaps has fallen on deaf ears. But the fact that he is wrongly accused of denying resurrection, mainly because he focused extensively on Olam Haba and did not in length discuss Kriyas Melechim, and based upon another factor, which is that he feels that when it comes to the doctrine of Yemot Mashiach, another one of his 13 principles of faith, to believe in the coming of the Messiah, the Rambam there says, one should not think that there's going to be anything that is supernatural. One should not expect the world to change from its natural order. And all of the prophetic verses that describe, most significantly, the verses in Isaiah and Yeshayahu, which describe the nature of the world changing and the nature of the wild animals changing, must be interpreted allegorically. The Rambam points to that and says, simply because I tried in my lifetime as a Jew and as a philosopher to minimize the miraculous nature, right? The Rambam will maintain that God wishes a world, wills a world that functions according to nature. And simply because I've allegorized those sukkim relating to Yemot HaMashiach, I have been misunderstood, and people have wrongly accused me and maintained that when it comes to resurrection, I don't believe there will be a miracle. I feel that those references of Chazal to the time of resurrection should also be understood allegorically. Some have accused me of saying that. And so the Rambam is again feels angry and resentful by this accusation that is made against him. The second part of the controversy, we will open next week's session, first 10 minutes to discuss the second half, and that of course will take place, as I mentioned, once the Rambam Mor Nebuchim is translated into Hebrew and is made accessible to Jews who are living in a Christian milieu, who are shocked, who are unprepared for what the Rambam presents in his Mor Nebuchim. Those Jews will be offended by the Rambam's approach and will lead a mission against the Rambam. I'll just end off by one more very quick idea about the controversy in the Rambam's lifetime. Is that there was an attempt made within the Rambam's lifetime to place a ban, a cherem, against the Rambam's Mishneh Torah. This ban was suggested by some of the figures that we mentioned here already, Shmuel ben Ali, the Gaon of Baghdad, by the Rizid, of Abraham ben David of Sirius, and by Meir Abulafia. However, that ban was not successful. But what we can see is that although that ban was not successful, it nonetheless established the precedent and set the ground for the later cherem that will be established by Jewish leaders in France a number of years later, and we'll discuss that, of course, next week. In next week's session, which is the last session, we will attempt to briefly look at the second half of the controversy and establish the position of the Ramban, Nachmanides, and we will also look at our final Jewish philosopher for this series, Yuval Baz, the thought of Gersonides. Thank you. If there are any questions, I will send out my email address again, and I wish you a Shavuot Tov.